It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for this afternoon, Bob F. from Monterey.
My name is Bob Ford, and I'm an alcoholic. I had this tin here I wanted to put in the basket, and it didn't come around. Oh, well. We'll save it. Don't bet. You'll lose. It's good to be here this afternoon, all things considered. Nice thing about being a young person who isn't that young anymore is if you don't like the crowd, you can always take your glasses off, and then they get anonymous, too. You won't do that yet. Someone was warning people that I'll put you to sleep. I understand you had a long night last night, so feel free if you need the rest. It may be a long night tonight, too. I don't really know how I got here today. Somebody asked me, and I think it was my brother-in-law. If you're new and you wonder how people get to be speakers anywhere, and you think that it has something to do with staying sober and being consistent and working the steps and all that sort of thing, that's what I always thought, but I understand that my brother-in-law mentioned my name, and I haven't seen him since. This was several months ago. And somebody told me that I was supposed to be here at 1 o'clock today, so here I am, and here we are. And I am to share with you some of what alcoholism and what Alcoholics Anonymous has been and is in my life today. It's really nice to see a lot of people here from Monterey, especially people that I don't sponsor or who I don't... Didn't mean like that one. I don't know whether you just want to find out if what Jim B. has been telling you is true or whether you're really here to support me, but I appreciate it anyway, whatever it is. I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous because that's the way it is. But what got me to the point where I felt that I belonged here isn't that much different from anyone else's story. I am from this area. My family's been in this area a long time, many generations. And there was always alcohol involved in our way of life. That's exactly what it was part and parcel of our way of life. The way that we did things always had something to do with drinking. And the kind of drinking that was done always had something to do with trouble. And I associated booze with, I guess, with adulthood and sophistication and laughter and always trouble also. That seemed to be part of the package that you just accepted. But long before I ever had a drink, I'll get to that. Before I ever had a drink, my earliest recollections were of bad feelings, of feelings that... God, I hate to use the same old cliche, you know, it's no one wants to be Carmen. I didn't feel like I was a part of. And of anything, of any place that I was early in my life. That's the first recollection I have of feelings and of intense anger and self-pity. For my lot in life, we were not, we were a family who, contrary to most American families, we lived below our means rather than beyond our means. And I'm sure that had a hell of a lot to do with the drinking that took place all the time. But those feelings, as I look back on them, made me ripe for alcoholism. And whatever else that X factor is that's involved. My brother, not an alcoholic. He's a heroin addict, but he wasn't an alcoholic. Didn't affect him in the same way. My older sister has no drinking or drug problems. She'd been married about 8 or 9 times now. And my youngest sister moved from Salinas to Santa Cruz, so she has some sort of a problem, I suppose. You can take it. I've been there on Easter. But always there was the drinking, and always there was the misguided examples, I guess. All my heroes were wrong in my life. You know, I've often described it, I wanted to be like Clint Eastwood all my life, before I ever knew who Clint Eastwood was, before I'd ever seen Clint Eastwood. But that type of a person, you know, where they, remember, what was that movie, Every Which Way But Loose, and he goes in the bar and he eats the peanuts, you know, and the guy gives him a hard time and calls him a bunch of names, and he just beats the snot out of him right there, you know, and it was absolutely called for. He was right in doing it. He never got arrested. Nobody asked him to pay for the damage. That's the way I always wanted things to be. Generally, I was the one who got the snot beat out of him. I had to pay for the damages to boot. So I never really got to be like old Clint, except in my head. And I was raised around big men, macho-type people, who, they were man's man types, outdoorsmen, and they were all well over 6 feet tall and well over 200 pounds, and I was the runt of the litter, and it was hard for me to accept that I wasn't like them, or like what I thought they were like, because as it turned out, they weren't really like that. Because alcohol was always around, it's hard for me to say, you know, I began drinking at such and such a time, because it just sort of was there, and I had access to it. I was drunk when I was 4 and a half years old. You know, but I didn't do that on purpose. Some guy was feeding me wine, and I got juiced up. And another time at a cocktail party, I went around draining the glasses. You know, it shows that they weren't keeping a very close eye on me, that's for sure. I wish they'd followed through on that when I got into my teens, but they began to tighten up a little bit. The tab got a little higher is why. But I got drunk draining these glasses at a cocktail party, and there was always a bottle of whiskey in the cupboard at home, and I learned to take my whiskey neat, and I loved whiskey. You know, I hear a lot of people say, oh, I just drank for the effects, I didn't like to taste of it. Boy, I did. On the way down, I did. I didn't care much for it on the way up, and it usually came back at me. I was reminded of that this morning as I was puking and thinking about being here. My linkage was a little messed up too. I kept going into reverse, and I didn't know what the setup was up here. But the well is not too deep, I'll tell you that. Just got a little bag there. The idea that I could never achieve what these other people had achieved, seemingly had achieved in their lives, was very vivid to me. That I would not be the person that my dad was, my grandfather was, my uncle was. You know, and as I got to know their lives after I grew up, or after I got older, reached the majority, I realized that their lives were not a bed of roses, and they were not the screaming, quote, successes that I thought. They had done all right with their lives, and they had done the best that they could. But that always my perspective was warped. It was a little out of balance, as usual. And what I thought was, wasn't. And what I tried to change the way I wanted it to be generally didn't work out. It gets pretty bad when your kids walk out, I'll tell you. A run out. The little town that I grew up in is Spreckles, California. Wonderful little town. There's a sugar factory and the Spreckles Emporium, when I was a kid, Tubby Jewelers, Signal Gas Station. Tubby was the guy that he could make one finger disappear because he had one finger cut off, and we kids used to go down and watch him all the time. That was really about all that was going on and stuff. It was Tubby Jeweler and the disappearing finger. And population always stayed the same, you know, and it was just, we lived right on the railroad tracks went behind our house, and the trains would go by carrying sugar beets to the factory, and the house would vibrate, and it was really, a shitty little town to live in. They'd open up those industrial waste gates there at the factory, and this odor would waft its way into everyone's home, and we would say, I think, Spreckles is ripe tonight was the phrase that we would use. And I worked in a detox center for a while, and I was often reminded of that town of my youth. There were some very familiar odors that we used to deal with. But I wanted to get out of Spreckles, but I didn't know where I wanted to go. You know, Salinas was about 5 miles away, and that was scary. When I was sober a year, I moved to Monterey, and that was like moving to another planet for me. You know, I was somebody who never really went anywhere in all areas of his life. You know, I went down as far as the drinking was concerned. When I was about 12 years old, I made a conscious decision to drink. You know, I knew what alcoholics were, and God, I was surrounded by them. And I made a conscious decision that I would drink the way that I was wanted to drink. My folks had a little cabin up in the mountains, and we would live up there every summer, and the controls were very, very loose. So I was able to drink with as much and as often as I wanted to. I was going to say with complete freedom, but freedom was not there. And I did. I drank. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And got sicker and sicker and sicker and more afraid inside and more closed into myself. Just trying to find something that I absolutely didn't even know what it was. I don't even know if it existed within my frame of reference. But I looked and I looked and I drank and I drank, and I wanted to have fun, you know, that excitement. And it was there, sometimes in a positive way and most of the time in a negative way. People came and go in my life, you know, came and went, and rapidly. By the time I was a senior in high school, there was no doubt in my mind that there was something wrong with me, and it had direct roots in my drinking. That I was an alcoholic. I didn't use the term that much then. Just, you know, I have a problem with my drinking. But I didn't think that there was anything that I could do about that. You know, I graduated from high school, and I went to junior college in Salinas, and the drinking increased, if that were possible. A tremendous capacity for alcohol, you know. Just unbelievable. I wouldn't pass out that much. I'd black out and come out of blackouts, in and out during an evening, but I wouldn't go down for the count because of the amount of alcohol that I had. I'd always stay awake to do as much damage as I could and pay the price for it later. The violence began to occur almost every time I picked up a drink. There would be some kind of violent behavior, and someone would get hurt, me and or someone else. The police would inevitably be involved. There were some horrible scenes. You know the scenes. The things that, I forget, somebody asked me when I was some months sober one time that, don't you ever miss drinking, you know? And this panorama just whirled through my head of, you know, some of the stuff that would go on. Some of the places that I found myself when I had started out just to have a good time. You know, one night I got drunk and was in a bar where there were about 3 people that I'd gone to high school with, and I was pretending that I was from Australia and thinking that I was getting by with it. And somebody called my bluff, and I left the bar with somebody to have a drink somewhere else, and the next thing I know we're in the street in a fight, and the car is still rolling, and I'm out in the street, and I'm trying to kill this person with a tire iron, and I jump in the car, and I escape, and I wake my father and mother up, and I'm screaming, I got to get out of the country, and I've killed someone, and oh God, and you know, he made me go to sleep on the couch, and I waited till everybody quieted down, and I took off. I had a roommate, an apartment in town, and I went there, and I stuck a gun in his face and robbed him of all of his money that night so I could go to Mexico, which I thought was about 2 blocks from Los Angeles. And if that wasn't insane enough, then I drove to Mexico that night. Only I made it to North Hollywood and turned around and came back. That was the day of the rats coming out from under the couch. They were clever little devils. And, you know, I'm no stranger to hearing music and saving electricity while you're listening to it because nothing's plugged in anywhere, you know. I guess I date myself, though. The only music I ever heard when I was having those hallucinations was Mantovani strings. It was never like the Grateful Dead or something really snappy. It was, I guess snappy is not the word. I don't know. I used to have a Cow Sales album. I remember them. You hear a lot of hip, slick, and cool people. You're not listening to one today. Tried to get a Princeton hairdo one time, my head shaped wrong, you know, and it was hanging this way and swooped up over here, and so they had to give me a butch haircut just to make it look decent. I never did. My idea of dressing in the modern mode was there were a pair of lavender and dark blue suede shoes at the shoe outlet in Salinas that I wanted so desperately, and my parents wouldn't buy them for me. Never understood why. You know, now I'm sober, I could buy those shoes. My wife said, and wear them alone, yes. What I'm trying to get across to you, which is probably already obvious, I was not really a hipster or whatever the hell we were back in the late 50s. And I never knew that. When I was in the 8th grade, I went to school one day and all the girls were crying. Now, you know why, probably. And I didn't know what the hell was going on. They said, the Big Bopper and Buddy Holly and Richie Valens plane crashed. And I thought they lived in Salinas. I didn't know who the hell these people were. I think Richie Valens, I probably knew who he was, but I didn't know who these others were. And, you know, I never had the nostalgia that I have for the 50s and 60s is what I get from watching Happy Days or something like that. Because it all just went by me. I was drinking in those years. You know, I'd go to the 8th grade drunk. And all through high school, junior high and high school drunk. Anybody ever drink Manchester beer? There's not many of us still alive, I know, that drank it. We're the ones with the green complexion. You know. We used to drink Manchester beer all the time, and before school, you know, I always had algebra first period, and it made it very bearable. I didn't pass algebra. They had to transfer me out of there, but at least I didn't mind. To this day, when I read something about a spiritual axiom, I think they talked about axioms in algebra one time, but I was out of it that day. And I didn't take pills. I smoked marijuana twice in my life, and I thought I was going to get drunk. I kept waiting to get drunk, you know, and nothing. I didn't. Everything around me got interesting. I remember that. The walls and the ceiling got interesting. Everything got really interesting. But that's, you know, that stuff. I didn't know. That's, you smoke marijuana, you end up, you know. I saw a film when I was in school. There were about 40 people smoked one joint, and they stole a case of beer and broke the bottles, and the blood was coming out of their mouths and all that, you know. Not me. No way. Crazy, but not dumb. And I read a lot, you know, stuff like that. You know, the Five Little Peppers and How They Grew. That was one of my favorite books. Joe's Boys and Little Men. And that was basically my life. You know, was reading and stealing booze from my parents. And that was about it. We didn't have a TV until I think The Untouchables were on the air when we finally got a television set. Now I'm catching up on Bachelor Father and stuff like that on the reruns. And we just, you know, I didn't know any other way to live, and I didn't like what I had. But what are the alternatives? You know, I suppose I should throw this in. I was raised a Roman Catholic, and, you know, it's the church. I don't know whether anybody's shafted the church from the podium today, so I might as well take my shot. I was an altar boy. And at Spreckles Church, we had a, there was a, there was not the Church of St. Spreckles or anything, it was an old Lutheran church that they moved from Salinas, and it was St. Joseph's Church. And the priest was Father Wong. We had a Chinese priest, yes. And I went to confession to him once because I figured he didn't speak English too well, you know. 50 Our Fathers, 100 Hail Marys and 100 Glory Bees, and a rosary. I was in my early teens. You can imagine what I had to tell him when I went into confession at that time. He didn't go for that. So I was an altar boy. I felt good. I was very proud of being an altar boy, and my family was proud of it. My being an altar boy, my being in the church, brought my dad back into the church after 20-some-odd years being out of the church. My mother converted to Catholicism. And that was, in a way, that was a positive thing. In the sense that it gave me, you know, the churches, not just the RCs, but all the churches really get bummed up to level. I stop and think about my childhood. There was a degree of stability was put into my life. A degree of fear was put in my life, too. But a degree of stability was there solely because of my involvement with my church. And it wasn't really the bad thing that I thought it was. As my scope widened and more bizarre opportunities presented themselves, I was longer and longer in the booth. You know, you keep hearing that sharp intake of breath, as you say. And then, mine was always, I stole money out of my mother's purse, and I stole some cigarettes, and I used the Lord's name in vain, and I did impure things, and I was late for school. And wait a minute. What do you mean you did impure things? With whom? And how many times? With me every day. More than once. Then. Yeah. Nothing was right that was good, you know. Everything I wanted to do was bad, or I wasn't able to do it well. Now I find out some of the things I thought were bad are good, but I can't do them as frequently or as well. She's nodding. But I am grateful for the church, because I'll tell you something, they instilled in me, at least, even though there was a tremendous amount of fear, and I think the wrong slant or emphasis on it, they instilled in me a very basic, rock-bottom, can't-throw-it-behind-me belief in a power greater than myself, the existence of. Although I knew that as time went on and I became more active in sin, that I was not worthy. You know, the nuns used to have Sister Mary Estelle, God rest her. I'm sure she's gone by now. She must have been 35 then, you know, God. She had a picture of the soul on this, what are those flannel blackboards, you know? And every time you sinned, there was a black mark. It's like shingles, you know, when they come around and meet, you die. I guess you go to hell when they all just turn black. And that made an impression on me, I'll tell you. I'll tell you one other, and then we'll leave her alone. It made a real impression on me. It kept me away for quite a while. Usually when you're sort of coming off a drunk, you know, and you don't know whether it's afternoon, late afternoon, or early morning, that kind of a feeling, or where you are, or what you're laying in. You don't want to move because you suspect you know what it is. I would always remember, not always, but frequently I would remember the story that Sister Maristel told us about purgatory. A man was dying a very painful death, and an angel appeared to him and said, "You could die now, spend 3 days in purgatory, or you'll suffer for a few more months, die, and go to heaven." He said, "I can't take it, I'll go now." Dead. Thousands and thousands of eons drag by, and this man is in the agony of purgatory. He yells to the angel, and the angel comes to him and says, "What's the matter?" He said, "You know, you are not keeping up your end of the deal. You said 3 days. It's been, can't even count how long." He said, "Your body's not cold yet." That'll make a believer out of you, I'll tell you. So I would remember that at the most inappropriate times, and I knew that that was in store for me. And there wasn't any way out of it. And I began to think about a being that could do that to someone, you know. I can't help the way I am. I'm weak. I didn't have the brakes, on and on and on, all these things, you know. And I'm not sure what's right and what's wrong, the confusion and everything, you know. And the only time that I really knew, really was certain about anything, was when I was drunk. I was certain that I didn't give a damn about anything. And that was fine with me. That's what I wanted. I had an old 52 Pontiac that somebody said, that, you know, "You better be careful in that car. All your wheel bearings are going on." I don't know what that means either. That's another thing. All the guys used to work on cars, and I never did. I'd put gas in one end and oil in the other and something. So I would drive this car top speed, you know, 50, 60, whatever it would do. And it had the visor and these skirts and a two-barrel carburetor about this big around. And I'd scream, "I don't care, I don't care." And I literally did not care, you know. And that was always the point that I was looking for, to not care. Let's get out of there. So that violence, that not caring, that my world just began to shrink more and more and more. You know, I was institutionalized many, many times, jails and institutions, Agnew State Hospital. Once after I got sober and something connected with the work that I was doing, we had to go to Agnew State Hospital and look at something up there. And as we were driving around, we went past old Ward 9, which is where I was. Ward 9, it was a country club of Agnew. It was really nice. I didn't like it there, but there was one guy who had been there about 15 years. And I knew that was going to be me someday, that I would be there that long. Got worse and worse. The music, the things that weren't really there that I saw, the fear, constantly the fear, especially the fear of, "I hope I don't get drunk today," knowing that I would, and knowing that the law of averages was catching up with me. You know. I had, through good living and all that sort of thing, had reached the fantastic weight of 125 pounds, and in December of 1965, I made my first call to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was just short of 20 years old, and I was done. I had had it. Every major catastrophe outwardly that was going to happen to me had happened. I had been married and divorced in about that length of time. And that was a total disaster. Burst in about that length of time. And that was a total disaster. And just all these things had happened, you know, and the things, even the things I haven't told you about, you know, the real mortal sins. Not just the venials, but the mortals. I was just done. I was through. And so some old guy came out and talked to me. And he said something about, I said, what about my friends that drink? And he said, you won't want to be around them. And I thought he said that in AA, you don't let me go around my friends. How could I give up this great crowd I was running with? I think there were about three or four people left that would be seen with me by then. And I thought, no, this is not it. You know, and I was drunk, and I called again, and two guys came out and took me to a meeting in Salinas. And I looked around the room, and there wasn't anybody there under, well, under my age at this time, right now, my age. And I thought, if people that old, you know, they probably should quit drinking, but not me. So I filed it away. I would call AA from time to time, and you know, I tried other avenues of recovery, and nothing worked for me, and I knew nothing would. To me, that epitomizes alcoholism, the total lack of hope in my life. Absolutely, there isn't anything to look forward to except all the things that have been happening that are bad and worse until sometime, you know, the record reaches the end and that's it. And then I know I have to look forward to something there, you know, too. So, the end of the rope was reached, the knot was tied in it. I kept doing and doing it and doing it, skirting disaster, you know, flaunting the law of averages. And in 1967, I came to AA again, and I stayed sober this time for 30 days, which was long enough for me to see that people stay sober here and that there's more to relate to than just people's age. And then I got drunk. And I got drunk for simple logic, very logical, that I better get drunk before I stay sober, you know. Makes sense to me. And I did. I got drunk before I stayed sober. And then I stayed sober a little while longer, and then I got mad at somebody and I left, and I came back and I stayed sober a little while and left, you know, in and out, in and out. And that's always lovely, because if you think it's bad when you aren't in AA and you're without hope, try being in and out of AA without any hope. Now the only thing you've ever seen that works doesn't work for you. And you're a real loser. When you're drunk, you want to be around AA people, and you can't be, really. And when you're sober, you want to be out there with somebody else, and you know you don't fit out there anymore. And the book talks about that in the 11th chapter, you know. And you're riding the four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. That was the case with me, you know. And I really literally got to the point where I didn't think I could live without drinking, and I didn't think that I could live with it, just like they said. That came. There weren't many, you know, who in the hell wants to think about what the yets could be? Well, let's see, you know, I never had intercourse with a yak, you know, I mean, I'm not looking forward to what I didn't do. What I did do is what got me here. And that was enough. And believe it was enough to almost kill me. I was dead inside. When I finally, in 67, you know, and it in and out and in and out, and finally in March of 68, I had what has been to date my last drink in 13 years and 7 months and some odd days. Give enough a clap for that. Let me tell you about young. I was young. There wasn't any young around when I got to Salinas young. Sometimes I say, I never went around hitting on young newcomer girls. There weren't any. And if there were, you know, 125 pounds? No. So, that was good. I'm the kind of guy who wants to have all the answers. So what I did was I listened to what the people who'd been sober a long time said in the meetings, and then I tried to prove that they were mistaken, that they had the wrong information, that they hadn't read the book right. And I began to read, that sent me to the book. And I read the books. I read the pamphlets so that I could be an authority on these things. And something happens to you when you do what you're supposed to do, no matter what your motive is. What happens to you is what is supposed to happen to us here. I began to change in the way, in the sense that I wanted this. I believed that I could stay sober. The day that I stopped drinking that last time, I realized one thing, and that was that I was going to die of alcoholism, and that it was extremely important for me not to take a drink, just one drink that day. It took all that time for me to realize that basic truth. I didn't yet realize that if I didn't take the first drink, I wouldn't get drunk. I just knew that I couldn't take the first drink that day, right then. Didn't stay here in this stupid-ass Alano Club. Stay with these people. There's this old first sergeant. That one time I was leaving to get drunk, and this guy was a retired first sergeant. He screamed at me, "Sit down. You don't do that. You don't tell people they can't get drunk. This is AA. I can get drunk that day." And there were people that I stayed sober because I thought they didn't want me to. That's how sick I was. And it doesn't matter. Your motives really don't matter. They just don't matter one particle. I got a sponsor. He was 6 weeks sober. And then he got drunk, so I got another sponsor. But I got a sponsor. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, where I did, at that time there were a number of people who, they weren't quite sold on the effectiveness of writing your fourth step. So there would be pro and con discussed about that, and I thought, what the hell does, what do people say to put this thing together, maybe I can become an authority on fourth stepping. So I read the book, and they didn't say I had to write it. They just assumed that I would. They said we referred to our list, and things like that. Little simple references to the fact that you write it. So I wrote it. I took it to a priest and did the fifth step with this priest, and he told me that I shouldn't be fooling around with this Al-Anon that I was fooling around with. So I quit going to church again. Decided that maybe that wasn't a real searching and fearless moral inventory. When I was sober over a year and I had moved over here, I did do the four step thoroughly. It took me some months before I felt that I had everything down on paper. And I took the fifth step with my sponsor. And I felt what they promised me I would feel. I felt that sense of freedom and cleanliness that I had never known before, ever in my life. And a degree of that has stayed with me. What I felt that day couldn't possibly stay with me constantly. I'd go insane. It was a tremendous feeling. But I realized also that I was accepted by someone. When I was sober almost a year, I realized living in a man's garage in Salinas, a man who took pity on me and took me into his home, even though I was sober about the same length of time as he, I was not a pleasant person to be around, not as pleasant as I am today. And I realized in that garage that a very profound thing. If I don't take a drink today, I will never get drunk. Tremendous. It was like an explosion inside of me when I realized that. The simple, simple truths. If I don't take a drink today, I'll never get drunk. And I realized at the same time, that very day, I know exactly the moment, the place, and the posture I was in when that happened to me. I realized that no matter what happened in my life, no matter how much I didn't like the circumstances, I didn't want to drink. If I had to live in that goddamn garage the rest of my life, with three walls surrounding me, because he had a carpet hanging on the fourth wall. Everything I owned in two Safeway grocery bags, some blankets and a rubber sheet. Yes. Bottles are only a symbol of our underlying problems. That was all right. I could accept that. And I said on my knees that day, God, no matter what, don't let me drink. no matter what. And I say that today. Not in the desperation that I felt then, but with the same depth of sincerity. I don't want to drink. That's why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because it's made me such a wise person, or several people call me sponsor, all the other good things that have happened in my life, because I got a sport coat, my hair lays down, you know, and I don't wet the bed anymore. That's, let me tell you, that's almost as great a feeling as when you quit drinking and begin to realize that maybe it's going to stick, you know. Is when you can't remember when the bed was wet. That was a terrible feeling. I don't want to drink. I remember what it was like. And I used to think, these guys have been sober 5, 6, 8, 10, 15, 20 years. They don't remember what it's like. Well, they had a lot of assholes like me waking them up in the middle of the night to remind them what it was like. So they remembered, I'll tell you. And they were the ones that put the phone by the bed. And they were the ones who were on the list for the answering service. And they were the ones that were at the meetings consistently when I was there. They were the ones with the cars that they had put the gas in and they had made the payment on that gave me rides to meetings and rides home to whomever's home I was spending up at the time. People will take care of you in Alcoholics Anonymous. They'll take care of your physical needs and they'll take care of your emotional needs, provided you don't take a drink. It's really that simple. For the most part. A lot has happened to me in the time that I've been sober. You know, much more than we have time to go into here. You know, the outward obvious things are different. I don't weigh 125 pounds anymore. I weigh 180, 90, 2, 10. 25 is as high as I'll go. 225. And it's probably less because I threw up this morning, remember? And the other thing, you lose weight on that too. But some simple truths have stayed with me. I was at a meeting last night and the subject of personalities came up. And my feeling is about that, is that the tradition says what it says. What does it say? Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Nowhere near does it tell me that I will never see personalities. Thank God for that, because I see them. You know, I've always been prone to that. And each time I see the personality and I allow myself to place it before the principle, I have cut myself off from that spiritual awakening that began for me on March the 8th of 1968. I know that. Sometimes knowing that even helps me minimize it. Usually what helps me minimize it is the pain of doing it. See, that old gentleman that was a friend of AA in the early days, that priest, Father Ed Dowling, who said most folks get to heaven backing away from hell. No. I didn't get twanged on the head with the 12 steps and then decided that I ought to do everything right from now on. You know, those things come hard for someone like me, you know, the power-driving, ambitious, egocentric. God, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And its people. We are really tremendous people. You know, not anything to pat ourselves on the back about or be, quotes, proud of. You know, they call the Jews a chosen people. And they've been getting it in the rear end for 2,000 years, you know. We are chosen. We've been chosen for something so great, you know, that when I look... Any of us take our lives before we got here and the lives that we have today and look at the tremendous difference. It's like night and day. And coupled with that absolute rock bottom knowledge that no way was my life going to change. This truly is a miracle. Absolutely. And we're confronted with miracles every day of our lives. it drives me up the wall when some personality, some people say, oh, yeah, never going to make it. I've seen people make it, unquote, in AA, who didn't have anything to make it with when they got here. Couldn't say one and one is two. Had grave emotional and mental disorders. Had nothing to do with their age or background. Had a lot to do with a spiritual awakening, a power greater than myself. When I was about 7 years sober, I moved out of the Monterey area, and I lived in the San Joaquin Valley. It was prior to my seventh year, a little bit. And I knew no one, I knew one lady over there. I had known her by seeing her at conferences. There's friends of mine that are from that area here today that I met over there, who were a great part of my life while I lived there. Who brought great joy to me by their friendship, added to that spiritual awakening. But a funny thing happened to me on the way to Madera, California. What happened was I was not surrounded by the familiar faces in my home group, which I don't know if there's anybody else who belongs to, but my home group's the Monterey Bay group in Monterey, California. Which shows that even people in a circus can stay sober, you know. The lack of familiar surroundings scared the hell out of me, and I realized that I'm the guy who has to put his hand up. We're the friendliest bunch of people in the world once you grab our hands. It's getting the motor cranked up to get it started, you know. And I always know what you're thinking of me, so why should I bother? You're not going to like me anyway, you know. Someone's told you about me, you know, whatever, or you just saw. I began to stick my hand out, and I took some risks. Said something to a guy in a meeting one night that was hurting very badly, and he asked me to be his sponsor, and he started staying sober, and somebody else, not because of me, but because of what happened with us in that relationship. Somebody else asked me, and a little bit, little by little, you know, those people draw close, and you draw close to them, and from them to other people, and that fellowship experiences. But I realized that it was about time that I had a working relationship rather than just a belief in God. And I began to do some things, spiritual exercises for me, went back to my church, and began to pray on my knees again. I had always said, doesn't matter what posture the body's in, as long as the soul is on its knees. That's a nice one. It's good to say at an 11-step meeting at a step study group. You sound really intellectual. You know, unless somebody who said it before sitting there, then they know what you really are, and it doesn't start with an I either. You know. That, I believe today, that there's more to life than just this life that I have. And I know it because there's more to my life today than there was 6 months ago, 6 years ago, 13 years ago, 20 years ago. And I know that someday this existence will end and it'll be a change. And I believe very strongly in that. That this spiritual awakening is going to go on and on as long as I so choose to do the things that are necessary. The basics, to never be sober too long. I was reminded last night that I've gotten lax about shaking speakers' hands and thanking them. That's not a ploy to get you to shake my hand. Just leave a dollar on the table, be fine. That people should be thanked because they said yes, you know. And the yesers are a minority. That personalities play a great part in my life. There's nothing wrong with seeing personalities. Can't always be looking at the principle, and sometimes I miss out some good things about your personality if I'm just going to look at it with those black and white blinders. But writing people off, which was always a good trick of mine, has been, is to a degree today, that's spiritual suicide. To remain open to God's will in my life. And I know what God's will is today. Always wondered what it was. It seemed to be such a deep spiritual secret. This morning it was to wake up and throw up. And I swear it's not because I was afraid to come and talk to you, because I didn't feel fear. I felt some apprehension, some nervousness. You always do. Otherwise, motive's wrong. But because I'm a glutton, I think, is why I got sick. My wife fixed a big dinner last night, and she probably put something bad in there. Fixed a big dinner, and then I had to stop at the Dairy Queen on the way to the stag meeting and eat a parfait, you know, with all this goopy crap on it and everything. You know, it was still there waiting this morning, I'll tell you. God's will for me is to do what the hell's in front of me, and to do it within this framework that I've been shown here in Alcoholics Anonymous. To say yes when I am asked to participate, to share what I have. The book tells me that better than I could ever come up with it. Give freely of what you have found and join us. Join us. Being a part of what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous means for me to be a part of what goes on in the mainstream of life. There is no in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. Everything in my life is touched by, the thread of Alcoholics Anonymous runs through it. Whether it's my membership in the Lions Club in my community, my job, the professional thing that I might belong to along with my job. It runs through that. Because without that thread, none of it ever held together. And God, as I understand God today, wants me to know His love better through you. And I believe that's all that God asks of me. That's God's will for me. And the issue gets clouded over and over again with my humanity. It's good to be human. And it's also good to be spiritual, to have that mixture. And to know that the human isn't always dominating the spiritual. And to know that I haven't gotten so spiritual that I'm no earthly good anymore. See. Somebody stopped me on Alvarado Street one day with a little pamphlet and said, have you thought about Jesus today? And I said, just as you were coming up, I said, Jesus Christ, here comes another one. We don't want to get pushy, you know. I want to get better enough that I am willing to do on a daily basis the things that I have to do when they make sense to me and when they don't. I've been sober a relatively long period of time, but I still take direction from my sponsor. And I'm twice as big as he is and about 5-6 years younger or so. Because I have to be careful of me. My old sponsor, his sponsor, always says, you know, every time I think I know God's will, you know, the exact specifics of it comes out in my handwriting. And that's what I have to watch out for. God wants me to, whatever. I just get up. I know I have to work. Dr. Bob told us that in his last talk. Love and service. Those are the important things in life. And the love is given to me in all kinds of ways every day through Alcoholics Anonymous, contacts that I have there. You know, love means that when it's the premiere episode of Taxi and the phone rings and somebody wants to vomit in my ear and it's an emergency, I must listen. My humanity says I don't have to listen happily, but I better listen. That's part of that love and service. And that extends throughout our lives. Again, I don't think we can separate. I certainly cannot separate for myself what is AA in my life and what isn't AA, because there isn't any separation. It all is. I am really grateful to have been here. I am grateful that I did not poop my pants or throw up while I was talking. There was some question. My wife has a pint in her purse, only it's Pepto-Bismol. And the feeling that I have in this room. I always thought when I was new that the epitome of success of having arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous was to be a speaker. And when I came into AA, they had a little platform and the speaker sat up there. And I wanted that badly. Well, finally I was asked to speak and they quit using the platform, see. And then when I was in HNI as the chairman of this AA 11 some years back, the guy ahead of me was given a plaque that the guys had made in wood and metal shop when he finished his term. And I wanted a plaque so bad. God, I wanted a plaque to put on my wall. And my sponsor at that time told me, there's a plaque on the wall at Beacon House and there's a plaque on the wall at Sun Street Center and they're both two men who are drinking now. One died drunk. Well, now both of them did. Think about it, he said. Finally, I got a plaque. I served on the statewide H&I committee, and we all got the same goddamn plaque. A form plaque. I don't even know what it is now. I don't know what I need in that area, what I, you know, what my wants are in that area. I know that my life has meaning today. There's a little thing that Dag Hammarskjöld wrote that sticks in my mind. I don't know the exact words to it, but it really impressed me because it sums up really what's happened to me and happens to me in AA. It had something to do about, I don't know who asked the question or even when I answered, but I know that somewhere along the line I said yes to something, and from that point on my life has had meaning, and that's the way I feel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.